good horse, I called you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the dark.
You're listening to episode 583 of Unwelcome Guests. Unwelcome Christmas Truths. I'm Robin Upton. And a seasonal variation this week, looking at Christmas, as well as the darker truths which underlie the money system. We're going to continue later with David Graeber, but first, a seasonal song by Sean Morey.
Dear Santa, this is Billy from Dallas. I would like a big wheel, the air conditioning package, and power steering, and CD player, and also a Sony PlayStation. Dear Santa, this is Raul from Venezuela. I want a stick. Big burn for heat. Dear Santa, this is Jessica from Aspen. I would like a Barbie dream house with an electric sports car and lots of outfits and matching outfits for me too, please. Dear Santa, this is Lupe from Paraguay. I want some rain to drink. Dear Santa, this is Joe from North Chicago. I want a new bike and a G.I. Joe with kung fu grip and grenade launcher. Dear Santa, this is Azid from Yemen. I want a grenade launcher. Dear Santa, this is Jimmy from Long Island. I want an electric train set with the whole village and the mountains and the tunnels and a robot to clean my room. Dear Santa, this is Babu from Ghana. I want an electric scooter, rollerblades, a DVD player, and an MP3 player. Just kidding, I want a stick. Dear Santa, this is Roo-da-dee-da-doo from Calcutta. I want a fly swatter. One that doesn't hurt when you hit yourself in the face. Dear Santa, this is Wang Sui Ming Fu from China. I want an electric Tonka fire truck with a ladder that goes up and down and the working siren and the flashing lights like the ones I make a frickin' day for 2 cents an hour.
And we're now going to return to David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Now, last week we concluded by wondering what kind of society could be based on the principle of blood debts and organize itself around that. Well, David Graeber will later go on to talk about Roman law and how the concept of slaves, slavery, rights, and property, ownership of other people, although it seems abhorrent to many of us, still manages to underwrite our understandings of ourselves, at least as that is expressed by institutions such as law, national government, the money system, and so on. Now, we're going to read for the next half hour or so before we turn to the audio of a documentary, Christmas Unwrapped, about the pagan roots of the Christmas festival. Blood debts. Lily. How does a token of recognition that one cannot pay a debt turn into a form of payment by which a debt can be extinguished? If anything, the problem seems even worse than it was before. In fact, it isn't. The African evidence clearly shows how such things can happen, though the answer is a bit unsettling. To demonstrate this, it'll be necessary to look at one or two African societies with a closer focus. I'll start with the Lili, an African people who had, at the time that Mary Douglas studied them in the 1950s, managed to turn the principle of blood debts into the organizing principle of their entire society. The Lili were, at that time, a group of perhaps 10,000 souls living on a stretch of rolling country near the Kasai River in the Belgian Congo, and considered a rude backcountry folk by their richer and more cosmopolitan neighbours, the Kuba and Bouchong. Lele women grew maize and manioc. The men thought of themselves as intrepid hunters, but spent most of their time weaving and sewing raffia palm cloth. This cloth was what the area was really known for. It was not only used for every sort of clothing, but also exported. The Lele considered themselves the clothiers of the region, and it was traded with surrounding people to acquire luxuries. Internally, it functioned as a sort of currency. Still, it was not used in markets, there were no markets, and, as Mary Douglas discovered to her great inconvenience, within a village, one couldn't use it to acquire food, tools, tableware, or really much of anything. It was the quintessential social currency. Quote, informal gifts of raffia cloth smooth all social relations, husband to wife, son to mother, son to father. They resolve occasions of tension, as peace offerings, they make parting gifts or convey congratulations. There are also formal gifts of raffia which are neglected only at risk of rupture of the social ties involved. A man, on reaching adulthood, should give 20 cloths to his father. Otherwise, he would be ashamed to ask his father's help for raising his marriage dues. A man should give 20 cloths to his wife on the delivery of each child. Unquote. Cloth was also used for various fines and fees, and to pay curers. So, for instance, if a man's wife reported a would-be seducer, it was customary to reward her with 20 cloths for her fidelity. It was not required, but not doing so was considered decidedly unwise. If an adulterer was caught, he was expected to pay 50 or 100 cloths to the woman's husband. If the husband and lover disturbed the peace of the village by fighting before the matter was settled, each would have to pay 2 in compensation, and so forth. Gifts tended to flow upward. Young people were always giving little presents of cloth as marks of respect to fathers, mothers, uncles, and the like. These gifts were hierarchical in nature. That is, it never occurred to those receiving them that they should have to reciprocate in any way. As a result, elders, and especially elder men, usually had a few pieces lying around, and young men, who could never weave quite enough to meet their needs, would have to turn to them whenever time for some major payment rolled around, for instance, if they had to pay a major fine, or wished to hire a doctor to assist their wife in childbirth, or wanted to join a cult society. They were thus always slightly in debt, or at least slightly beholden, to their elders. But everyone also had a whole range of friends and relatives who they had helped out, and so could turn to for assistance. Marriage was particularly expensive, since the arrangements usually required getting one's hands on several bars of camwood. If raffia cloth was the exchange of social life, camwood, a rare imported wood used for the manufacture of cosmetics, was the high denomination currency. 100 raffia cloths were equivalent to 3 to 5 bars. Few individuals owned much in the way of camwood, usually just little bits to grind up for their own use. Most was kept in each village's collective treasury. This is not to say camwood was used for anything like bride wealth. Rather, it was used in marriage negotiations, in which all sorts of gifts were passed back and forth. In fact, there was no bride wealth. Men could not use money to acquire women, nor could they use it to claim any rights over children. The Lele were matrilineal. Children belonged not to their father's clan, but to their mother's. There was, however, another way that men gained control over women. This was a system of blood debts. It's a common understanding among many traditional African peoples that human beings do not simply die without a reason. If someone dies, someone must have killed them. If a Lele woman died in childbirth, for example, this was assumed to be because she'd committed adultery. The adulterer was thus responsible for the death. Sometimes she would confess on her deathbed. Otherwise, the facts of the matter would have to be established through divination. It was the same if a baby died, if someone became sick, or slipped and fell while they were climbing a tree. One would check to see if they'd been involved in any quarrel that could have been said to have caused the misfortune. If all else failed, one could employ magical means to identify the sorcerer. Once the village was satisfied that a culprit had been identified, that person owed a blood debt. That is, he owed the victim's next of kin a human life, The culprit would thus have to transfer over a young woman from his family, his sister or her daughter, to be the victim's ward or pawn. As with the TIV, the system quickly became immensely complicated. Pawnship was inherited. If a woman was someone's pawn, so would her children be, and so would her daughter's children. This meant that most males were also considered someone else's man. Still, no one would accept a male pawn in payment of blood debts. The whole point was to get hold of a young woman, who would then go on to produce additional pawn children. Douglas's Lilly informants emphasized that any man would naturally want to have as many of these as possible. Quote, ask, why do you want to have more pawns? And they invariably say, the advantage of owning pawns is that if you incur a blood debt, you can settle it by paying one of your pawns, and your own sisters remain free. Ask, why do you wish your own sisters to remain free? And they reply, ah, then if I incur a blood debt, I can settle it by giving one of them as a pawn. Every man is always aware that at any time he is liable for a blood debt. If any woman he's seduced confesses his name in the throes of childbirth and subsequently dies, or if her child dies, or if anyone he's quarrelled with dies of an illness or accident, he may be held responsible. Even if a woman runs away from her husband and fighting breaks out on her account, the deaths will be laid at her door, and her brother or mother's brother will have to pay up. Since only women are accepted as blood compensation, and since compensation is demanded for all deaths of men as well as women, it's obvious that there can never be enough to go around. Men fall into arrears in their pawnship obligations, and girls used to be pledged before their birth, even before their mothers were of marriageable age. Unquote. In other words, the whole thing turned into an endlessly complicated chess game. One reason, Douglas remarks, why the term pawn seems singularly apropos. Just about every adult Lele male was both someone else's pawn and engaged in a constant game of securing, swapping, or redeeming pawns. Every major drama or tragedy of village life would ordinarily lead to a transfer of rights in women. Almost all of those women would eventually get swapped again. Several points need to be emphasized here. First of all, what were being traded were, quite specifically, human lives. Douglas calls them blood debts, but life debts would be more appropriate. Say, for instance, a man is drowning and another man rescues him. Or say he's deathly ill, but a doctor cures him. In either case, we would likely say one man owes his life to the other. So would the Lele, but they meant it literally. Save someone's life, they owe you a life. And a life owed had to be paid back. The usual recourse was for a man whose life was saved to turn over his sister as a pawn, or if not that, a different woman, a pawn he had acquired from someone else. The second point is that nothing could substitute for a human life. Compensation was based on the principle of equivalence, a life for a life, a person for a person. Since the value of human life was absolute, no amount of raffia cloth or camwood bars or goats or transistor radios or anything else could possibly take its place. The third and most important point is that even in practice, human life actually meant woman's life, or even more specifically, young woman's life. Ostensibly, this was to maximize one's holdings. Above all, one wished for a human being who could become pregnant and produce children, since those children would also be pawns. Still, even Mary Douglas, who was in no sense a feminist, was forced to admit that the whole arrangement did seem to operate as if it were one gigantic apparatus for asserting male control over women. This was true, above all, because women could not themselves own pawns. They could only be pawns. In other words, when it came to life debts, only men could be either creditors or debtors. Young women were thus credits and debits, the pieces being moved around the chessboard, while the hands that moved them were invariably male. Of course, since almost everyone was a pawn, or had been at some point in their lives, being one could not in itself be much of a tragedy. For male pawns, it was in some ways quite advantageous, since one's owner had to pay most of one's fines and fees and even blood debts. And this is why, as Douglas's informants uniformly insisted, pawnship had nothing in common with slavery. The Lele did keep slaves, but never very many. Slaves were war captives, usually foreigners. As such, they had no family, no one to protect them. To be a pawn, on the other hand, meant to have not one, but two different families to look after you. You still had your own mother and her brothers, but now you also had your lord. For a woman, the very fact that she was the stakes in a game that all men were playing afforded all sorts of opportunities to game the system. In principle, a girl might be born a pawn, assigned to some man for eventual marriage. In practice, however, quote, a little Lily girl would grow up a coquette. From infancy, she was a centre of affectionate, teasing, flirting attention. Her affianced husband never gained more than a very limited control over her. Since men competed with one another for women, there was scope for women to manoeuvre and intrigue. Hopeful seducers were never lacking, and no woman doubted that she could get another husband if it suited her. Unquote. In addition, a young Lily woman had one unique and powerful card to play. Everyone was well aware that if she completely refused to countenance her situation, she always had the option of becoming a village wife. The institution of the village wife was a peculiarly Lily one. Probably the best way to describe it is to imagine a hypothetical case. Let us say that an old, important man acquires a young woman as a pawn through a blood debt, and he decides to marry her himself. Technically, he has the right to do so, but it's no fun for a young woman to be an old man's third or fourth wife. Or, say he decides to offer her in marriage to one of his male pawns in a village far away from her mother and her natal home. She protests. He ignores her protestations. She waits for an opportune moment and slips off at night to an enemy village, where she asks for sanctuary. This is always possible. All villages have their traditional enemies. Neither would an enemy village refuse a woman who came to them in such a situation. They would immediately declare her wife of the village, and all men living there would be obliged to protect her. It helps to understand that here, as in many parts of Africa, most older men had several wives. This meant the pool of women available for younger men was considerably reduced. As our ethnographer explains, the imbalance was a source of considerable sexual tension. Quote, everyone realized that the young, unmarried men coveted the wives of their seniors. Indeed, one of their pastimes was to plan seductions, and the man who boasted of none was derided. Since the old men wished to remain polygynists, with two or three wives, and since adulteries were thought to disrupt the peace of the village, Lily had to make some arrangement to appease their unmarried men. Therefore, when a sufficient number of them reached the age of 18 or so, they were allowed to buy the right to a common wife. Unquote. After paying an appropriate fee in raffia cloth to the village treasury, they were permitted to build a collective house, and then they were either allotted a wife to put in it, or allowed to form a party that would try to steal one from a rival village, or alternatively, if one showed up as a refugee, they would ask the rest of the village for the right to accept her, and this was invariably granted. This common wife is what's referred to as a village wife. The position of the village wife was more than respectable. In fact, a newly married village wife was treated very much like a princess. She was not expected to plant or weed in the gardens, fetch wood or water, or even to cook. All household chores were done by her eager young husbands, who provided the best of everything, spending much of their time hunting in the forest, vying to bring her the choicest delicacies, or plying her with palm wine. She could help herself to others' possessions, and was expected to make all sorts of mischief to the bemused indulgence of all concerned. She was also expected to make herself sexually available to all members of the age set, perhaps 10 or 12 different men, at first pretty much whenever they wanted her. Over time, a village wife would usually settle down with just 3 or 4 of her husbands, and finally just one. The domestic arrangements were flexible. Nonetheless, in principle, she was married to the village as a whole. If she had children, the village was considered to be their father, and as such expected to bring them up, provide them with resources, and eventually get them properly married off, which is why villages had to maintain collective treasuries full of raffia and camwood bars in the first place. Since at any time a village was likely to have several village wives, it would also have its own children and grandchildren, and therefore be in a position to both demand and pay blood debts, and thus to accumulate pawns. As a result, villages became corporate bodies, collective groups that, like modern corporations, had to be treated as if they were individuals for the purposes of law. However, there was one key difference. Unlike ordinary individuals, villages could back up their claims with force. As Douglas emphasizes, this was crucial, because ordinary lele men were simply not able to do this to one another. In everyday affairs, there was an almost complete lack of any systematic means of coercion. This was the main reason, she notes, that pawnship was so innocuous. There were all sorts of rules, but with no government, no courts, no judges to make authoritative decisions, no group of armed men willing or able to employ the threat of force to back those decisions up, rules were there to be adjusted and interpreted. In the end, everyone's feelings had to be taken into account. In everyday affairs, Lele put a great stock on gentle and agreeable behaviour. Men might have been regularly seized with the urge to throw themselves at each other in fits of jealous rage, though often they had good reason to, but they very rarely did, and if a fight did break out, everyone would immediately jump in to break it up and submit the affair to public mediation. Villages, in contrast, were fortified, and age sets could be mobilized to act as military units. Here, and only here, did organized violence enter the picture. True, when villages fought, it was always over women. Everyone Douglas talked to expressed incredulity at the very idea that grown men anywhere could ever come to blows over anything else. But, in the case of villages, it could come to an actual war. If another village's elders ignored one's claims to a pawn, one's young men might organize a raiding party and kidnap her, or carry off some other likely young woman to be their collective wife. This might lead to deaths, and to further claims for compensation. Since it had the backing of force, Douglas observes dryly, the village could afford to be less conciliatory towards the wishes of its pawns. It's at exactly this point, too, where the potential for violence enters, that the great wall constructed between the value of lives and money can suddenly come tumbling down. Quote, "Sometimes, when two clans were disputing a claim to blood compensation, the claimant might see no hope of getting satisfaction from his opponents. The political system offered no direct means for one man, or clan, to use physical coercion or to resort to superior authority to enforce claims against another. In such a case, rather than abandon his claim to a pawn woman, he would be ready to take the equivalent in wealth, if he could get it. The usual procedure was to sell his case against the defendants to the only group capable of extorting a pawn by force, that is, to a village. The man who meant to sell his case to a village asked them for 100 raffia cloths, or 5 bars of camwood. The village raised the amount, either from its treasury or by a loan from one of its members, and thereby adopted as its own his claim to a pawn." Unquote. And once he held the money, his claim was over, and the village, which had now bought it, would proceed to organize a raid to seize the woman in dispute. In other words, it was only when violence was brought into the equation that there was any question of buying and selling people. The ability to deploy force, to cut through the endless maze of preferences, obligations, expectations, and responsibilities that mark real human relationships, also made it possible to overcome what is otherwise the first rule of all lele economic relationships, that human lives can only be exchanged for other human lives, and never for physical objects. Significantly, the amount paid, 100 cloths, or an equivalent amount of camwood, was also the price of a slave. Slaves were, as I mentioned, war captives. There seem never to have been very many of them. Douglas only managed to locate 2 descendants of slaves in the 1950s, some 25 years after the practice had been abolished. Still, the numbers were not important. The mere fact of their existence set a precedent. The value of a human life could, sometimes, be quantified. But if one was able to move from A equals A, one life equals another, to A equals B, one life equals 100 cloths, it was only because the equation was established at the point of a spear. Flesh debt, TIV. I've dwelt on the lele in such detail in part because I wanted to convey some sense of why I was using the term human economy. What life is like inside one, what sort of dramas fill people's days, and how money typically operates in the midst of all this. Lele currencies are, as I say, quintessential social currencies. They're used to mark every visit, every promise, every important moment in a man's or woman's life. It's surely significant, too, what the objects used as currency actually were. Raffia cloth was used for clothing. In Douglas's day, it was the main thing used to clothe the human body. Camwood bars were the source of a red paste that was used as a cosmetic. It was the main substance used as makeup, by both men and women, to beautify themselves each day. These, then, were the materials used to shape people's physical appearance, to make them appear mature, decent, attractive, and dignified to their fellows. They were what turned a mere naked body into a proper social being. This is no coincidence. In fact, it's extremely common in what I've been calling human economies. Money almost always arises first from objects that are used primarily as adornment of the person. Beads, shells, feathers, dog or whale teeth, gold and silver are all well-known cases in point. All are useless for any purpose other than making people look more interesting and hence more beautiful. The brass rods used by the TIV might seem an exception, but actually they're not. They were used mainly as raw material for the manufacture of jewellery, or simply twisted into hoops and worn at dances. There are exceptions, cattle for instance, but as a general rule, it's only when governments and then markets enter the picture that we begin to see currencies like barley, cheese, tobacco, or salt. It also illustrates the peculiar progression of ideas that so often mark human economies. On the one hand, human life is the absolute value. There is no possible equivalent. Whether a life is given or taken, the debt is absolute. In places, this principle is indeed sacrosanct. More often, it is compromised by the elaborate games played by the TIV, who treat the giving of lives, and the lele, who treat the taking of lives, as creating debts that can only be paid by delivering up another human being. In each case, too, the practice ends up engendering an extraordinarily complex game, in which important men end up exchanging women, or at least rights over their fertility. But this is already a kind of opening. Once the game exists, once the principle of substitution comes in, there was always the possibility of extending it. When that begins to happen, systems of debt that were premised on creating people can, even here, suddenly become the means of destroying them. As an example, let's once again return to the TIV. The reader will recall that if a man did not have a sister or a ward to give in exchange for one's wife, it was possible to assuage her parents and guardians by gifts of money. However, such a wife would never be considered truly his. Here, too, there was one dramatic exception. A man could buy a slave, a woman kidnapped in a raid from a distant country. Slaves, after all, had no parents, or could be treated as if they didn't. They'd been forcibly removed from all those networks of mutual obligation and debt in which ordinary people acquired their outward identities. This was why they could be bought and sold. Once married, though, a purchased wife would quickly develop new ties. She was no longer a slave, and her children were perfectly legitimate, more so, in fact, than those of a wife who was merely acquired through the continual payment of brass rods. We have perhaps a general principle. To make something saleable in a human economy, one needs to first rip it from its context. That's what slaves are, people stolen from the community that made them what they are. As strangers to their new communities, slaves no longer had mothers, fathers, kin of any sort. This is why they could be bought and sold, or even killed, because the only relation they had was to their owners. A lele village's ability to organize raids and kidnap women from an alien community seems to have been the key to its ability to start trading women for money, even if, in their case, they could do so only to a very limited extent. After all, her relatives were not very far away, and they would surely come around demanding an explanation. In the end, someone would have to come up with an arrangement that everybody could live with. Still, I would also insist that there is something more than this. One gets a distinct sense in much of the literature that many African societies were haunted by the awareness that these elaborate networks of debt could, if things went just slightly wrong, be transformed into something absolutely terrible. The TIV are a dramatic case in point. Among students of anthropology, the TIV are mainly famous for the fact that their economic life was divided into what their best-known ethnographers, Paul and Laura Bohannon, referred to as three separate spheres of exchange. Ordinarily, everyday economic activity was mostly the affair of women. They were the ones who filled the markets and who trod the paths, giving and returning minor gifts of okra, nuts, or fish. Men concerned themselves with what they considered higher things, the kind of transactions that might be conducted using the TIV currency, which, as with the lele, consisted of two denominations, a kind of locally made cloth called tugudu, widely exported, and, for major transaction, bundles of imported brass rods. These could be used to acquire certain flashy and luxurious things, cows, purchased foreign wives, but they were mainly for the give and take of political affairs, hiring curers, acquiring magic, gaining initiation into cult societies. In political matters, TIV were even more resolutely egalitarian than the lele. Successful old men, with their numerous wives, might have lorded it over their sons and dependents within their own house compounds, but beyond that, there was no formal political organization of any sort. Finally, there was the system of wards, which consisted entirely of men's rights in women. Hence the notion of spheres. In principle, these three levels, ordinary consumption goods, masculine prestige goods, and rights in women, were completely separate. No amount of okra could get you a brass rod, just as, in principle, no number of brass rods could give you full rights to a woman. In practice, there were ways to game the system. Say a neighbour was sponsoring a feast, but was short on supplies. One might come to his aid, and then later, discreetly, ask for a bundle or two in repayment. To be able to wheel and deal, to turn chickens into cows, as the saying went, and ultimately, to broker one's wealth and prestige into a way of acquiring wives, required a strong heart, that is, an enterprising and charismatic personality. But strong heart had another meaning too. There was believed to be a certain actual biological substance called salve, which grew on the human heart. That was what gave certain people their charm, their energy, and their powers of persuasion. Salve, therefore, was both a physical substance and that invisible power that allows certain people to bend others to their will. The problem was, and most TIV of that time appear to have believed that this was the problem with their society, that it was also possible to augment one's salve through artificial means. And this could only be accomplished by consuming human flesh. Now, I should emphasize right away that there is no reason to believe that any TIV actually did practice cannibalism. The idea of eating human flesh appears to have disgusted and horrified them as much as it would most Americans. Yet, for centuries, most appear to have been veritably obsessed by the suspicion that some of their neighbors, and particularly prominent men who became de facto political leaders, were in fact secret cannibals. Men who built up their tsav by such means, the story went, attained extraordinary powers, the ability to fly, to become impervious to weapons, and to be able to send out their souls at night to kill their victims in such a way that their victims didn't even know that they were dead, but would wander around, confused and feckless, to be harvested for their cannibal feasts. They became, in short, terrifying witches. The Mbatsav, the Society of Witches, was always looking for new members, and the way to accomplish this was to trick people into eating human flesh. A witch would take a piece of the body of one of his own close relatives, whom he'd murdered, and place it in the victim's food. If the man was foolish enough to eat it, he would contract a flesh debt, and the Society of Witches ensured that flesh debts are always paid. Quote, "Perhaps your friend or some older man has noticed that you have a large number of children, or brothers and sisters, and so tricks you into contracting the debt with him. He invites you to eat food in his house, alone with him, and when you begin the meal, he sets before you two dishes of sauce, one of which contains cooked human flesh." Unquote. If you eat from the wrong dish, but you do not have a strong heart, the potential to become a witch, you will become sick and flee from the house in terror. But if you have that hidden potential, the flesh will begin to work in you. That evening, you will find your house surrounded by screeching cats and owls. Strange noises will fill the air. Your new creditor will appear before you, backed by his confederates in evil. He will tell of how he killed his own brother so that you two could dine together, and pretend to be tortured by the thought of having lost his own kin as you sit there, surrounded by your plump and healthy relatives. The other witches will concur, acting as if all this is your own fault. You have sought for trouble, and trouble has come upon you. Come and lie down on the ground, that we may cut your throat. There's only one way out, and that's to pledge a member of your own family as a substitute. This is possible because you'll find you have terrible new powers, but they must be used as the other witches demand. One by one, you must kill off your brothers, sisters, children. Their bodies will be stolen from their graves by the College of Witches, brought back to life just long enough to be properly fattened, tortured, killed again, then carved and roasted for yet another feast. Quote, "The flesh debt goes on and on. The creditor keeps on coming. Unless the debtor has men behind him who are very strong in salve, he cannot free himself from the flesh debt until he has given up all his people and his family is finished. Then he goes himself and lies down on the ground to be slaughtered, and so the debt is finally discharged." Unquote. The slave trade. In one sense, it's obvious what's going on here. Men with strong hearts have power and charisma. Using it, they can manipulate debt to turn extra food into treasures, and treasures into wives, wards and daughters, and thus become the heads of ever-growing families. But that very power and charisma that allows them to do this also makes them run the constant danger of sending the whole process jolting back into a kind of horrific implosion, of creating flesh debts whereby one's family is converted back into food. Now, if one is simply trying to imagine the worst thing that could possibly happen to someone, surely being forced to dine on the mutilated corpses of one's own children would, anywhere, be pretty high on the list. Still, anthropologists have come to understand, over the years, that every society is haunted by slightly different nightmares, and that these differences are significant. Horror stories, whether about vampires, ghouls, or flesh-eating zombies, always seem to reflect some aspect of the teller's own social lives, some terrifying potential in the way they are accustomed to interact with each other, that they do not wish to acknowledge or confront, but also cannot help but talk about. And we're going to take a break now for our main feature on Christmas. I think this is a fascinating point by David Graeber about how the stories that one culture tells and its activities on a surface level have meanings which are widely understood, and yet these only arrive because they echo and amplify deeper meanings which are going on, deeper stories which are told perhaps over generations through the collective unconscious, if you like. I'm now in Europe and seeing capitalist Christmas. It strikes me as, in a way, hauntingly familiar from the perspective of a Muslim Eid. Now, I'm sure those religious traditions have a lot of differences which are not reflected at all in their modern incarnation as collective incitements to shop, buy gifts for people, and eat together. Not that there's anything wrong with those activities necessarily, but I don't appreciate the way that religious traditions are being used to promote that kind of activity. And now let's break for another seasonal song. This is Red Star Over the Christmas Tree by rathergood.com. And if you go there, or if you go to our website, unwelcomeguest.net/583, you'll find an engaging video animation.
It's Christmas Eve and Santa drops his gifts around the nation. I want some agricultural collectivization. There's nothing stirring in the house, it's quiet all night. Tomorrow, if we're lucky, all the workers will unite. Cause there's a red star up on the Christmas tree. A hammer for you and a sickle for me. Goodwill to all men, let's celebrate by purging the enemies of the state. Tomorrow I will hold you tight and kiss you, my sweet darling. I'll give you chocolate Trotskys and a Christmas candy Stalin. We'll play with Christmas crackers wearing festive paper hats and hope for dictatorships of some proletariats. Cause there's a red star up on the Christmas tree. A hammer for you and a sickle for me. Goodwill to all men, let's celebrate by purging the enemies of the state. Games and darts. We'll read some Papa books by Engels, Hegel, and by Marx. What Christmas cheer we'll have, or yes, we'll never have a cheerier. And we'll say, boys must come to work to death out in Siberia. A red star up on the Christmas tree. A hammer for you and a sickle for me. We'll throw men, we'll celebrate.
And now we're going to hear the audio track of a video, Christmas Unwrapped, and that video also is available for download from our website, so that is a recommended way to view this. Now, for many of us, if we think about what is the true meaning of Christmas, we may think not about buying products, but about the birth of Jesus Christ. But interestingly, there's not a lot about Christmas in the Gospels. And it turns out that the tradition of Christmas owes a lot more to the pagan midwinter festival than it does to anything in the Gospels. Now, just as the non-reality of Santa Claus is an unwelcome truth to many youngsters, this could be an unwelcome truth to adults. What is Christmas really about? Be warned that Christmas has never been the same for me since I saw this video.
It has been called the Day of Days. It is a time of magic, pageantry, warmth, generosity, and love. For many of us, our fondest childhood memories revolve around the traditions of Christmas. It is a time that many around the world celebrate as the birth of Jesus Christ, the Savior and Messiah of mankind. In recent years, however, the spiritual holiday has become a time of mass marketing and crass commercialism. Incredibly, many businesses derive more than half their yearly income during this period. The process of gift-giving, once thought to have come from the story of the wise men who offered gifts to the newborn Christ, has evolved into the buying frenzy we see today during the month of December. But what about the other Christmas traditions? Have you ever wondered why we decorate the Christmas tree? Why we light the Yule log? Why we hang the mistletoe? And why we teach our children to believe in Santa Claus.
In the next hour, you will discover the true origins of Christmas. You may be surprised or even shocked to learn the source of your favorite holiday traditions. Chances are, you'll never look at Christmas the same ever again.
Northern Hemisphere during late December, the days are at their shortest lengths and the nights are at their longest. For those of the pagan world, this has always been the greatest time of the year to celebrate and practice the works of darkness. The pagan calendar identifies this period as the winter solstice. It was during the pre-Christian midwinter pagan celebrations of Scandinavia's Norsemen where today's Christmas traditions began. As a means of honoring the pagan sex and fertility god Yule, a 12-day celebration during the month of December was inaugurated. A large single log considered to be a phallic idol was lit on fire and kept burning for 12 days. Animal or human sacrifices were offered in the fire on each of those days. Wild, delirious reveling accompanied the daily sacrifices as drunken participants defiantly strove to make contact with spirits. 1,000 miles away in pre-Christian Rome, celebrants were paying homage to their own gods during the winter solstice. Witchcraft traditions hold that a number of pagan gods were given birth during this period, including Dionysus, Attis, and Baal, chief male god of fertility and licentiousness. Another pagan god from Persia, identified as Mithra, was said to have been born specifically on December 25th. Mithra was the god of the unconquerable sun, the god of the light between heaven and earth, worshipped at that time by an influential Roman cult. His birth symbolized an end to the long nights and a return to the dominance of the sun. During the month-long winter solstice celebration, courts in Rome were closed. Any and all crimes were allowed. Homosexuality, cross-dressing, and uncontrolled debauchery reigned supreme. Rome's order was turned upside down. Even children were allowed to join in the drunken orgies as part of the Juvenalia celebration. By 270 AD, the Roman Emperor Aurelian had made it official, setting aside a 7-day period from December the 17th through the 24th, culminating in an exchange of gifts on December the 25th to celebrate the birth of the sun god. This Roman orgy to end all orgies later became known as Saturnalia, in honor of the god Saturn, the god of excess. Roman soldiers invading Britain brought with them their pagan orgiastic traditions. Upon taking root in England, Saturnalia became known as the festival of fools reigned over by the Lord of Misrule. By the 4th century, the influential government-sanctioned Church of Rome, unable to outlaw the growing number of pagan practices, chose instead to adopt them into their so-called official Christianity. The church believed this would attract more pagans to their fold. Up until this time, the birthday of Jesus Christ, the Jewish Messiah, had not been celebrated at all. Ignoring scriptures, however, indicating that the birth probably did not occur during the winter, the church nevertheless confused biblical history and made Jesus' birthday coincide with the pagan god Mithra. The birth date of the sun god had now become the birth date of the Son of God. It was hoped that the pagan celebrations of Saturnalia would merge into this new legally sanctioned form of Christianity. The church's practice of changing the dates of Christian events to coincide with pagan festivals continued, and by the 7th century, Pope Gregory I had ordered Augustine of Canterbury to incorporate any and all pagan practices and customs into the expanding Roman Catholic Church. During the Middle Ages, the debased Mardi Gras atmosphere of what was now known as Christ's Mass had reached a fevered pitch. Common practices included open sex in the streets, rioting, murder, and a number of pagan druidic Halloween rituals. This blood-drenched celebration got so out of hand that by 1652, following the execution of King Charles I, Christ's Mass was finally outlawed in England. A religious reform movement began sweeping the country, led by Puritan Oliver Cromwell. The Puritans took the biblical mandate seriously, which commanded that Christianity remain pure and separate from paganism. Despite their noble efforts, the celebration simply went underground, and by 1656, after only 4 short years under the ban, the public's demand for the legalization of Christ's Mass had become insurmountable. The appointment of Charles II to the throne restored England's monarchy, and with it the celebration of Christ's Mass. The Puritans had lost England, but they held high hopes for the new world.
When the first settlers came from England, they were, for the most part, Puritans. They came here for religious freedom. They came here to be free to worship God without a hierarchy and without the corruption of the organized church that they had known before. And when they came with the clear knowledge of the danger of these pagan practices that had become so dear to the hearts of their ancestors.
Following England's lead in 1659, the colonies of America had likewise outlawed Christmas. For 200 years, the clergy in New England battled to keep the riotous celebrations honoring the pagan god Saturn from infiltrating the New World. The Reverend Cotton Mather had warned in a Christmas Day sermon in 1712, "Can you in your conscience think that your holy Savior is honored by hard drinking, lewd reveling, and by a mass fit for none but Baucus or Saturn?" But the public's taste for sin and revelry persisted. In 1828, gang rioting during the Saturnalia-like Christmas celebrations got so bad that cities such as New York were forced to institute a professional police force for the first time in order to control the savagery.
Christmas was not only not widely celebrated, in many cases, many places, Christmas celebrations were actually outlawed. And this was because of the attitude of many of the churches, who regarded it as primarily as a pagan celebration and as a reproach to the Lord.
By the mid-19th century, American churches were the last remaining holdout in the war against the validation of Christmas. However, they too finally succumbed as a result of the efforts of the American Sunday School Society, who began advocating Christmas programs for children as a method of filling the pews. The Society argued that children could be taught about the birth of Christ through the reenactment of the Nativity. They also offered candy and treats to the children as a means of enticing families into accepting the holiday, despite its notorious history and blatantly pagan roots. The successful technique of bribing children with candy would later be used on an unsuspecting American populace in the effort to promote the acceptance of the pagan rituals of Halloween. However, it was the work of England's most popular writer, Charles Dickens, whose ghostly 1843 book, A Christmas Carol, cemented the Christmas holiday in the hearts of Americans forever. Dickens' well-loved story made the pagan Christmas feasts, shining trees, glittering shops, and family warmth irresistible to those wanting to experience the holiday. Coming to America in 1867 to promote his work, Charles Dickens packed theaters as he read his story to cheering audiences around the country. A Christmas Carol gripped America and destroyed any final attempt to stop the evolution of Christmas. By 1875, the Puritans had been beaten. And by 1890, all American states had voted to make Christmas a legal holiday. Today's tradition of the Christmas Yule log stems directly from the worship of the pre-Christian Scandinavian fertility god Yule. The burning of this phallic idol is also responsible for the concept of the 12 days of Christmas, which represented the 12 daily sacrifices offered up in the Yule log's flames.
Another good example of the pagan elements of Christmas is the whole concept of Yule and the Yule log. The very term is derived from a Norse god, Yule, spelled J-U-L. And every year around Christmas time, a huge log was cut down and fashioned into a fertility symbol and then burned for 12 days, and on each successive day, a new sacrifice to the god Yule was performed in the fire, and a new sacrificial victim was burned to death. Sometimes, but not always, these sacrificial victims were human beings. And the whole notion of the 12 days of Christmas also comes to us from this Norse pagan tradition.
In an attempt to blur the origins of this horrific ritual, the Church of Rome placed the first day of the Mass of Christ on December 25th and the 12th day on January the 6th. Despite no scriptural references for January the 6th, it was selected as the day the wise men supposedly arrived to offer gifts to the newborn Christ. This day then has become known as Epiphany.
During the Dark Ages, the European custom of putting an oil-lighted wick lamp in the windows during the 12 days of Christmas signified to neighbors that the occupants were participating in the pagan worship of the phallic idol Yule. In today's commercialism, this is where we get the tradition of decorating our houses with Christmas lights. The Yule log custom was originally brought over to America by Scandinavian immigrants during the 1600s. And despite attempts to ban the tradition, it has stayed with us to this very day. Today, when we wish someone Yuletide greetings, we are in a sense invoking the power of the fertility god Yule upon that person. During the Saturnalia celebrations, holly and other greens were hung over doorways as part of a pagan ritual to ward off evil. To deck the halls with boughs of holly was to acknowledge the powers of the nature gods. According to Wiccan rituals, placing holly or other greens in the shape of a circle or wreath accentuated its magical power. Similarly, mistletoe, when used in the casting of Wiccan or Druidic spells, could render a woman helpless and open to sexual exploitation. This is where we get our custom of hanging mistletoe in doorways today. And if a woman is caught underneath, she may be kissed and must not resist.
The fir tree, the mistletoe, all of these things typically come from overtly pagan traditions, from Northern Europe, German, Norse, and English.
Likewise, evergreen trees have always represented sex and fertility in pagan cultures. During the winter solstice, trees would be chopped down, brought inside, set up, and decorated as idols for worship.
The Christmas tree was regarded as a sacred tree. The pagans of Northern Europe typically worshipped trees. They regarded trees and groves as sacred. So the bringing of the tree into the house would be a way of bringing this supernatural source of blessing into your home. That was the whole idea, that there were spirits who resided in the trees.
In the Middle Ages, the tradition of the winter solstice Christmas tree primarily took root in Germany. During his reign, King George I, himself of German extraction, brought the custom to Victorian England. German immigrants settling in Pennsylvania did the same in America during the early 1800s. In 1848, the London Illustrated News published this famous engraving depicting Queen Victoria and her royal family beside a decorated Christmas tree. And within a few years, nearly every English household had their own tree in allegiance to the monarchy. By 1900, the U.S. Forest Service estimated that at least one in five homes in America had adopted the Christmas tree tradition. Thousands of years earlier, God, speaking through the prophet Jeremiah, warned against this pagan practice in the Old Testament. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the ways of the heathen, for the customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, they deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers that it move not. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither also is it in them to do good.